Hello and welcome to Bread and Rosaries, the leftist Christian podcast that just realised that when they did the notes yesterday, they forgot to write the rest of the intro. I'm Ben Molyneux-Hevington, and I'm joined by Adam Spears and Luca von Badass. Say hello, Adam.
Hello.
And say hello, Lou.
Hello.
We are also joined by returning guest, the Reverend Chris Howson. Last time Chris was here, we threw him a party to celebrate the 10th anniversary of his book, Just Church, which I can thoroughly recommend as a practical approach to liberation theology in a British church context. This time, I'm afraid we've got no streamers, no party rings. There's no awkward small talk in the kitchen either, though, so it might be better than having a party. Apart from being a guest on universally beloved podcasts and a published author, Chris, who on earth are you?
Well, I consider any moment in your presence a party, Ben, to be honest. It's like a, it's just an ongoing celebration of life and joy. So who am I? Well, I'm the chaplain at the University of Sunderland, way up in the northeast. And that means I spend a fair bit of my time with young people, students. Sunderland University is the biggest widening participation university in the country, which means we had to take a lot of people who wouldn't normally be in the HE level, and that throws its own sort of challenges. We're in a fairly poor part of the world. You know, the gap between rich and poor is pretty grim, but the Northeast, it feels even grimmer. So there's lots of challenges that come along with that. When I'm not working with students, I help in Sunderland Minster, which is a city centre church, where I've been experimenting with revolutionary types of worship for about 10 years. And before that was running a kind of church in Bradford called Soul Space, which again, tried to live out the principles of liberation theology in its worship in a more sort of dialogical, rounder form with lots of fun and controversies and a little bit of action involved with it, encouraging people to be participants in social issues. So that's the kind of stuff. And apart from that, I work a lot with refugees. So I run Sunderland City of Sanctuary and got a particular interest in working with Iranian Christians at the moment. But in general, trying to welcome all refugees into our midst. The last year, of course, a big part of that has been working with the Ukrainian community, and I coordinate the welcome for the Ukrainian families that are in the Sunderland area, which is about 150, 160 folk. We had a big party last night in the Bangladeshi Community Centre for the Ukrainians, and I'm still a bit sore from dancing way above and beyond what a man of my age should dance to. It was lots of fun. Actually, it was a bizarre night last night because I had three parties on at the same time.
What?
Oh, that's a sitcom premise.
Yeah, it was all happening at the same time. So I jumped on my bike, went down to 1719, which is an old church where they had a big show celebrating the life of Ida Cook, who was an anti-fascist who travelled between Sunderland and Berlin and Frankfurt in the 1930s, pretending to be an opera lover, though she was an opera lover, and helping people get their money, Jewish people, get their money to the UK, because you couldn't come to the UK unless you had money and had a sponsor. You know, the UK government in the 1930s behaved pretty nastily. What a surprise. There's some echoes of this.
We've got such a good record on this, haven't we? You know, yeah.
So incredible celebration of a life, and there's some beautiful musicians played this incredible music, and we had speakers from the refugee community from today sharing their story and linking the past with the present, and that was just incredible. So wonderful 2 hours of music, and then we had our a celebration for our Ukrainians. So 2 weeks ago we had a lot of stuff for the anniversary of the war breaking out, or the escalation of the war breaking out. And to be honest, all those things were pretty dire. You know, a lot of tears, a lot of heartbreak. Anniversaries are pretty grim. And so we really thought we'd throw a bit of a party, particularly for we got lots of kids in the Ukrainian community, a lot of mums with their kids. So it was more of a dance party. But when I got there, their music system was broken. Oh, my God. No music system. So no music was a disaster. Luckily, I'd bought a really cheap system for £90 from Cash Converters a week before. So someone drove me to the house. We got a system. on the way, there was a body in the middle of the road. So we had to ring up the ambulance and wait with the body. The body was okay. He was drunk. And we had to wait until police arrived. It was a bit of a mess. Anyway, the party got started. It was good. Then I had to go to my friend's 50th birthday party at Pop Rex. So I dashed over there. Yeah, it was nice to everyone. And then dashed back to help with the rest of the Bangladeshi community party for the Ukrainians. In the midst of all that, I actually got chased by 30 youths in the city centre who were egging people, attacking people in the city centre. And I don't put up with that sort of bullshit. So I kind of recorded them, chased them, got the police involved, and sorted that out. So it was a pretty full-on evening. Lots of dancing, a lot of chasing.
Some eggs.
Lots of ambulances and lots of police and lots of eggs.
Wow.
And eggs are rare at the moment, so, you know, you don't want them being thrown around. So I have no idea why I'm telling you that. Why the hell? Oh, because I work with the Ukrainians. There you go. That's where that went. Sorry about that. I didn't mean to take over your space. Carry on with your podcast. I know it's far more important than my evening's.
Your evening sounds so much like so much fun.
That might be the most interesting thing we talk about on this episode.
They sound exhausting, frankly.
It was sort of the evening I would have enjoyed 20 years ago, but now at 54, I'd rather be at home watching Happy Valley and watching the kids, you know, moan about, you know, parents. I don't know. You know, I would have been happier.
But whatever it is the young people do these days.
it was a really interesting night. And, you know, Sunderland is a really interesting city with lots of contradictions and challenges. And I love it here and I love being part of all that.
And lots of beaches as well.
Five beaches. Yeah. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it, Portsmouth. Five beaches up yours, Brighton.
Yeah, fuck your... Portsmouth. Yeah,
fuck Portsmouth.
Yeah, but frankly, even Swansea, the beaches are poor. We're the only city in the UK with five beaches, and they're really nice ones. So, it's pretty nice being up here.
Genuinely, you really have just bumped up Sunderland up my list of possible places to live. Because a city and a beach is the perfect.
There's dolphins there and everything.
Not in the city centre, but in the sea, definitely.
Just dolphins outside Greg's.
Queuing up, yeah. There's another thing that you're really interested in, Chris, that I wanted to kind of briefly get you to talk about, if I may. And that's your obsession with cemeteries. And I remember a few years ago, you started a campaign to restore a particular grave that you found. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I love dead things. And I love graveyards. And I love, you know.
That's not a commentary on Christianity, is it?
No. We're very proud in Sunderland of our connection with the graveyards of the UK. So I think in the 1820s, 1840s, we allowed in a ship from, I think it was Russia, which brought the plague to the UK and wiped out huge numbers of people in the UK, spread from Sunderland. And what that did was it overwhelmed all the churchyards of England. And you know, before that, you had to be buried in a churchyard by a church. But because Sunderland had meant so many people died all at once, they changed to put an Act of Parliament for cities to have cemeteries outside of the graveyards. So you had the birth of the great cemeteries in London and all the ones where Karl Marx is buried, all those places, all because of Sunderland allowing the plague into the country. So we're very proud of our connection with that. And I like travelling around the country and seeing some of these great cemeteries. Sunderland has got three fantastic cemeteries. And what I like about cemeteries is that they're great places to share surprising histories, stuff that people just don't know. It's where all our trade unions are buried. It's where all our suffragettes are buried. It's where all our anarchists are buried. And so you can use your graveyards to tell incredible stories and forgotten stories, hidden stories. Now, my wife on International Women's Day 2 years ago came across this grave that was fallen on its end. It was just laying flat on the ground. But we could tell from the inscription that there was something really unusual about it, and from the pattern, the mosaic that was on it, and it had this incredible thing. It said bold, cautious and true, and a loving comrade, and we knew instantly from that 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 was going to be a trade unionist or some sort of member of the suffragette party. And there was a woman called Mary. She doesn't have her own name. She's got a father's name, doesn't even have a husband's name. He kind of was out the track. But it was, and the emblem, the picture was of this blood red crescent moon, and it was in the colors of the suffragettes. And she died just after the first wave of women able to vote in 1919. She probably died of the Spanish flu, but got to see women get the vote, though we haven't got any proof that she exercised the vote in that first round. But anyway, so what we did is we just told this woman's story, Mary's story, tried to find out anything we could about her, which wasn't much, but we got people excited about the idea of a forgotten suffragette in Sunderland. And we got the money to raise to resurrect the grave and put it up and have the National Glass Centre polish up the beautiful mosaic. And it just looks stunning. And it's a kind of memorial. We always go there on International Women's Day. We were there last week to remember the kind of forgotten women of our cities who, you know, to have that kind of inscription on your grave, you must have been quite a remarkable character and an extraordinary person. And those women's stories are forgotten. But so I like cemeteries and I like graves and I like being able to tell stories about radical pasts. Use that. So I run Friends of Sunderland Cemeteries and we do litter picking and storytelling and all sorts of strange things like that in our local cemeteries. Who doesn't?
That's amazing. Thank you. We'll learn something new. A suffragette we didn't know about. That's so cool.
Oh, yeah. There were hundreds and thousands of them, you know, extraordinary folk.
Yeah.
But actually keeping cemeteries as a place of real lovely calm and reflection is really important. Our work started actually during the pandemic when we got a set of student halls in Sunderland and nobody was allowed out except for parks. Mm. But there aren't any parks in that part of the inner city. Mm. But nearby was this enormous graveyard. And so we were encouraging our students to get to know the graveyard and use it for their daily walks and things like that.
Yeah.
So graveyards, very useful things.
You didn't scare them off with stories of the plague, did you? Like, don't worry, all these people died of a plague, but you're not in any danger.
I didn't tell them that. I do, of course, do a cemetery walk on Halloween.
Cool.
Excellent.
As the sun is setting, and that's one of my favourite things to do.
That is appropriate.
Yeah, and I don't mind scaring people a little bit. What do they expect on Halloween? I got banned from doing it in Bradford after a group of students I took out. I hid behind one of the bigger graves and I leapt out at an inappropriate moment. And one of this lovely student from China, I think, dropped her camera and it smashed and she ran away screaming. And news got to the university somehow and I was banned from doing these Halloween walks.
Jesus weeps for Gaza. He sees the pain and suffering of the 1.9 million people who have been forced to leave their homes without access to nutritious food, clean water, decent shelter. He hears the cries of the 25,000 orphaned children. He is with all who mourn the 250 people killed every single day. Christians for Palestine UK is a group of Christians who are calling for an immediate ceasefire in Palestine. We don't pretend to have all the answers, but are united in our prayers, hope and action for equality, peace and justice for all the peoples of the Holy Land. Together, we are organising a Christian presence at the National Marches for Palestine and local Days of Action, where we've been joined by siblings from Sabil Kairos, Pax Christi, and a whole range of Christian churches. We urge you to join us to act in solidarity with the people of Palestine and call for a permanent ceasefire and just peace. The Very Reverend Canon Richard Sewell, Dean of St George's College in Jerusalem, says, "I warmly welcome the newly formed group, Christians for Palestine UK. Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank need to see the solidarity of Christians in the UK, and they will be encouraged to see your commitment to stand up for them in their time of terrible suffering. To find details of local actions or to join the Christian bloc at a national march, follow Christians for Palestine UK on Instagram and Facebook, or email christiansforpalestineuk@gmail.com. Join us as we call for a ceasefire now.
I can't see how a human being could resist doing the jumping out from behind a grave thing. Like, I think that's basic human nature to want to do that.
I mean, it's Halloween, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
What do they expect is going to happen? Also, it was the only time when I was got ordained, they kind of say, oh, you've got to have all these things. You've got to have your clerical shirt and all that kind of stuff. And they say, you've got to have this cloak. It's about to buy it. It costs a fortune. You have to buy this bloody cloak. You know, when are you going to use it? So, and I've never used mine. In fact, I've lost it now. But the only time I ever used it was on Halloween, when doing the Halloween walks. It is very good for scaring the bejesus out of people.
I'm gonna drag us back onto some sort of topic.
We
are going to start with a brand new segment that I think we are entitling New Podcast Same Old Nonsense. We have like 5 or 6 themes that we kind of talk about almost every podcast. So we're just going to try and be really quick and cover them. But we do have to talk about some of them. First off, Adam, Christian Concern, they're doing silly things.
Oh, Christian Concern are always doing silly things. So they're at it again. Christian Concern put up an article, if you can call it that, on their website that says, parents withdrew children from C of E school over gender-confusing book. And basically what it is that children are being taught that some people are born with the sex that doesn't match their gender identity, which is, you know, a fact.
And as always, when people say it's confusing, they don't mean it's confusing for the children. They mean the adults can't understand.
No.
Kids grasp it. They're fine. Yeah, it's the adults.
You tell a kid this stuff and they're like, okay, right? Like, it makes no difference. Like, they get it, right? It's the adults who overthink everything. And I mean, this book, it actually looks quite nice. It looks like it's quite sensitively done. It's called My Shadow is Pink, which is a fun concept by Scott Stewart. The quote from it that they give in this article says that the dad in the book says to his son, "Your shadow is pink. I see now it's true. It's not just your shadow, it's your innermost you."
Oh, lovely. How cool is that?
I know. I love it. Yeah. But no, this is terrible for Christian Concern because it apparently confuses children and is inappropriate for small children and is transgender propaganda. So there we go. Christian Concern at it again.
Christian sent out again. There we go. Next theme. I'm just going to bash through this one. Hillsong are under investigation for possibly doing financial fraud. We'll put a link to the full story in the show notes. It makes us hark back to the episode that we did on Hillsong, in which we were very careful not to commit, is it libel or slander? I can't remember which way around it is. But whichever one of those is spoken, we're careful not to say that they committed financial fraud, even though we probably implied it quite heavily.
I mean, we'd like to commit both of them, honestly.
But now we can say, looks like Hillsong doing financial fraud. So, yeah, they're being investigated for essentially using funds that were like essentially the equivalent in Australia of the UK's the funds that were for COVID furlough. So the Australian version of that was taken by Hillsong and used for buying some sort of venue, which is not really what they were meant to be for. They're meant to be keeping people in their jobs, plus basically tithe money being spent on swanky hotels for the pastor and all the sort of usual things you'd expect. So yeah, we did a whole episode about Hillsong that you can find in the show. But we just wanted to go back and say it's no longer libel or slander to say that they probably committed financial fraud.
That they may have committed financial fraud.
Yeah. The final thing we've got, which we might spend a little bit more time on than the others, but we've spoken about a few times recently, so we'll keep it reasonably short, is the ongoing awfulness of the government's refugee policy. We kind of talk about this every week, but then the government plumbs new lows. They've announced a policy, the big headline of which is essentially people who arrive on small boats are going to have a number of the usual rights taken away from them, including, most shockingly, they will no longer be allowed to utilize the modern slavery protections, which people have joked about it legalizing slavery, but that's not fair. It merely encourages slavery. It's not legal. It's just easier to get away with. It's just appalling.
Ben, you say it's getting worse. You say it's getting worse. They had a policy called pushback. Where they wanted boats to be pushed back into French water, where they could have easily just have died.
Yeah.
Now that got thrown out. I don't think that this isn't the sum. This isn't the worst bit. They've had worse policies in the past, and those policies have been proven impossible to work.
Yeah.
And been kicked out. As will this one.
Mm. This is part of their strategy, though, isn't it? You know, this is they know it's not going to work.
It's smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, but they want to make this the platform on which they scream as they can, you know, think about conducting the next general election, right?
For the Tories, this is the worst period of economic decline Britain has seen for since the 1920s. So standards of living over the next 10 years are going to be dropping down, and they've already dropped. We're not even at the standard of living we had in 2008, and it's all this has happened during a Tory government. Tory government that's brought us Brexit and various other joys, and of course Liz Truss's amazing budget, which plunged the country into financial chaos and confusion, and lost the respect of the city for the Tories. They're in a mess, and they are going to lose the next election, and they're desperate to do anything that might hold on to it. And of course, the two things that they normally go into is bash the immigrants, and secondly, law and order. Well, law and order is not working for them because they made such a mess of the policing situation. So they can't even say, oh, we're doing this on law and order, because they'd look really foolish. So they're going to go on, they're going to work on the refugee stuff. But I don't think they can get much worse than the policy they had 2 years ago of trying to push back people in boats. And they're only on the boats. They're only on the boats because they were forced there. 2018, there was hardly anyone coming across in boats. People who came, refugees I worked with, arrived in the back of lorries and arriving without their passports. All that now is taken away from them. There are no routes like that. You have to go on the boat. Mm. The Tories did that, nobody else. So they've concocted this mess. And, well, unfortunately, their way of getting out of it is causing more and more misery to that very vulnerable group itself.
And just the language, I think, even that whole point of when the Tories talk about, oh, safe legal routes. A safe legal route is so, so limited to a very, very, very specific kind of agenda but it's so dangerous. What they're peddling is the idea that, oh, look, we've got loads of safe and legal routes for loads of people who want to come over, blah, 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 for all these legitimate refugees or something. And it's not true.
Well, it's true for a very small number of people.
Yeah, for a very small number.
If you're from Hong Kong, the UK government thinks that it'd like to attract people from Hong Kong because, on the whole, people from Hong Kong were fairly wealthy. So that's one of the legal routes, is that route from Hong Kong. And of course, you know, a lot of people in Hong Kong trying to get away from the repression that the Chinese government are bringing into it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this week I saw a guy in a park in Sunderland, and I'd seen him the day before. And I went over to him just to see if he was okay. I thought maybe one of our local students who was homeless, having problems. You know, there's been a lot of housing issue for students. But he wasn't a student at all. He was someone from Hong Kong, come to the UK, and was finding things incredibly difficult. He wasn't one of these ones that got loads of money and got jobs, and so he's homeless on the streets of the UK. So we're allowing certain groups in, but the government kind of hoping that they're going to be all right. Of course, the Ukrainians have got a different scheme again, and they're protected a little bit by the hosting system. But now that's finished, the 6 to 9 months that people have been, a lot of our Ukrainians are having huge difficulties finding social housing as appropriate. The other safe route is, of course, when we take people from camps. We're taking Palestinians and Syrians, and all those things are really good, but it's a tiny number. And it's a tiny fraction. And of course, the joke is the UK takes, you know, one of the smallest numbers of refugees from anywhere in the world. You know, we slightly beat Iceland, but Iceland's even harder to get to, you know. But you know, we just take this tiny group of people, we're making that even more limited.
I'm now going to move us on to our next segment. We are going to do Saint of the Week. Cue the jingle.
Saint of the Week.
Chris, we don't have the ability to play jingles during the podcast. We drop it in afterwards, but it is a wonderful bit of harmonising from Lou.
I felt it. I felt it in my bladder. It was extraordinary. my bones. Sorry, that sounded a bit weird. I'm of a certain age, a man of a certain age. I feel a lot of things in my blood. Even jingles.
I am going to talk briefly about a few people. As established, Saint of the Week is, we are being very liberal with the naming of it, in that it's both fortnightly and also saint means person. And I am extending it this week to be people. So I guess it's Saints of the Week.
This has just lost all integrity. I'm sorry. I'm not sure we can allow this.
They are still Christian. They are saints in the broadest sense.
Go on in.
So I read the book Hammer and Hoe by Robin D.G. Kelly, which is a classic work of history about communists in the American Deep South in the 20s and 30s. That focuses particularly on issues of race and union struggles. There's a few cool people in it. There's a few cool, like, church leaders, ministers that are kind of pro-union stuff. My favourite is a guy called the Reverend George W. Reed. So basically every day he would just have a church meeting where he would take a Bible passage seemingly at random and preach on it, kind of off the cuff, with always the point of this Bible passage shows why union organizing is good, which I think is a fantastic approach to
excellent
to preaching.
Excellent. Yeah.
Oh, what are you showing me there?
Well, if you like this kind of stuff, you should see a film called Mate One, which is the true story of unions organizing in West Virginia in the 1920s. At the Stone Mountain Coal Company announces a cut in wages and miners respond in strike action.
Oh,
it's a brilliant
yes.
film. That tells some of the communist history with Chris Cooper and it's a John Sayles film. If you know who John Sayles is, he was he still is a left wing filmmaker who tries doing collaborative films. But Mate One, if you like that, that's the film to watch.
That is an official Brendan Rosie's recommendation there. Film club this week. Reverend Reed, he also had a bit of reputation for insulting other pastors locally, apparently including calling them common thieves because they steal from the poor and don't give them back anything. But the people I really want to talk about are some of the members of the women's organisations, which were quite powerful within the unions. And essentially, when a worker was refusing to join the union or not acting in solidarity in some way, particularly the black women in the women's organisations would be sent to deal with the black men who were not joining the union, basically by showing up en masse and telling them to sort themselves out. These were all regular church attending women. Mm-hmm. So they would essentially, you know, be doing church work on Sundays, doing loads of stuff to keep their churches running, and then the rest of the week they'd be going around threatening their men folk into doing union work. And if the particular men did not agree to do the union stuff properly, they would then go on a form of domestic strike, which basically meant no cooking, no cleaning, no sex until you sort yourselves out and join the union.
Hear, hear.
My saints of the week are the lovely church women who told their husbands that they weren't getting anything done for them unless they sorted themselves out and joined the union.
Yeah, we support that. We need that. We need more of that, I think.
Big up. No one listens to me when I say that around and about, do they? I just walk around going, no washing up, no sex, and I just get ignored.
Yeah, but so there was a white worker who was interviewed around the time, and they were asked what the kind of thought of the success of the union in that area was, and he said, I genuinely think the black women who basically keep the community running and keep their men on the straight and narrow about the union are the source of our success within the community, which obviously at that time was quite an extraordinary thing for a white man to be saying.
Mm-hmm.
But excellent stuff.
Cool.
Final segment before our main topic. We've got a couple of bits to mind grapes.
What else is on my mind grapes?
Adam.
Hello.
Did you want to talk about your favourite new Bible?
My favourite new Bible. Did I want to talk about my favourite new Bible? Oh, that one! Oh, my goodness.
Hang on.
Let me find
it. Flip it, egg.
Good Lord. I can't find it. Where is it?
Oh, well, never mind. Well, just say what's your favourite Bible, then.
Yeah, come on, Adam.
Oh, I don't know. The most conservative one I can think of. I mean, I love the ESV. You know, the ESV study Bible telling you that the death penalty is legitimate and stuff. Love that.
I was always surprised when, I mean, a lot of people love the King James Bible. I'm not going to slag it off, but I was so shocked when I realized when I was doing my theological stuff that when I read through that there isn't a St. James. There's no St. James. If you look at the Latin or the Greek, it's Jacob.
Mm.
His name is Jacob. But King James really wanted his name to be in there and that one of the disciples would be called James. And so from the King James onwards, one of the disciples is James, but it's not.
What?
Yeah. It's a bit of a shock, isn't it?
Mind blown.
And that's what happens when kings get hold of Bibles. They can just put in their own name. I'm going to do my own translation. And Christopher's not going to be one of these rubbish disciples who just helps people across rivers. I want a disciple. I want to be one of the 12.
You are going to be the rock. Christopher is the rock.
Yeah, let's go for the Peter's job.
Not,
yeah.
No, not as in Peter, as in the wrestler. You're going to be the rock. The
wrestler. I can see it.
You did a beautiful segue there. Because we are going to talk about what happens when kings get their hands on Bibles, aren't we, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, I still can't find the thing, but but what you're talking about is a new Bible that's been released to celebrate the coronation of Charles Windsor.
Is one of the disciples going to become Charlie? Because that's too far for me.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. But no, they have released or are releasing a new Bible to celebrate the coronation of Charles Windsor. And I just find this very odd. A coronation Bible. Do you know how much this costs as well, by the way?
No, go on, tell us.
95 quid.
Flipping egg.
Coronation Bible from the King's printer.
£95?
Yeah. A special commemorative Bible to celebrate the coronation of their Majesties King Charles III and Queen Camilla. I've actually found it now, you can tell.
And is it a King James version?
Do you know, it doesn't even say. That bit doesn't matter, apparently. all that matters is that it's a coronation, a commemorative coronation Bible, because all we actually care about is Charles III and not actually what it actually says in the Bible, I think.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the monarchy, but being in the Church of England, they do kind of make you do a lot of swearing on kings and bishops and things like that. And
we like to swear on kings and bishops.
It's really, really tricky, you know. So it's really hard to work out mentally what you're doing when all that is going on. But there are ways of getting around it, even if you're a staunch Republicans. So there are ways. Mm. I think there's no harm for us praying for the rich. I mean, Jesus, of course, loved the rich young man and spent a lot of time with wealthy people. But he was also trying to say, share what you've got. And I don't mind praying for kings and queens, but I want them to be in charge of a more just and equitable world, you know, and I want them to be turning their lives upside down. But I was still allowed to pray for them. And
well, I'll be honest, Chris. I agree with you. I think we absolutely should be praying for them. I think the question is what we're praying for them. And to be honest, like the prayers that I pray when I pray for them are that they would not be in charge anymore, that they would lose the privileges that they have, lose the position that they have, and actually gain something bigger in that.
I think we should move now to our main topic for the day.
Thank God.
We are going to talk about worship and worship spaces and how they can become more liberative and radical spaces. I am therefore calling this episode Liberation Liturgy, despite not entirely being clear what liturgy actually is. We are talking particularly, I think, about some of the ideas in liberation theology and what we'd call critical pedagogy. God damn it! I did a whole master's degree, dissertation on pedagogy, and I cannot get the word right any time.
Pedagogy.
Critical pedagogy. There we go. I'm not going to say that word again.
Very good. Very good.
So I think in order to have that conversation, it's probably a useful start for us to learn a little bit more about what those things are. So Chris, I'm looking at you here. Can you give us a vague introduction to what we mean by those things?
Well, I'm trying not to be vague. I'll try and be a bit very precise.
That's great. That would be a first of the podcast, but knock yourself out.
Liturgy is what we use when we have when the worship community comes together. So it's the words or the actions that we use. And if you've read my latest section in the book that came out last year on the it's the 40th anniversary of the Church Action on Poverty, and I was one of the guest editors of that book, and I went around the country looking at communities that were trying to listen to the poor in their liturgy and their worship. But one thing that really struck me was a lot of churches that are doing some really encouraging and wonderful things and trying to involve the local communities and working around issues of justice, and they're really good and they're having women's groups and all sorts of stuff. When you get to the Sunday, the worship is the same,
yeah,
as it's always been. And it also problematically mirrors some of the hierarchies in society and the dominant patterns that are part of the problem. So services are almost entirely, you know, triangular or pyramidical, you know, with a few people at the top who've got the knowledge and who kind of share their knowledge, and then lots of people underneath who kind of absorb the knowledge. Now, a guy called Paulo Freire, he wrote a book called Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Just try and pronounce it better than you, Ben. Pedagogy of the Oppressed was simply saying, you know, how do we teach oppression when our schools and our education processes mirror the pyramids of hierarchy, the problems we've got? How do we do that? And he devised a different way of learning. It had a big effect on Brazil, the country was in helping peasants to learn languages and literacy, but had a big effect on how teaching is done in general. So he criticized the banking method, the idea that there was a bank of knowledge that was poured out into little people. He also called it the jug and the mug principle, that there was a jug of knowledge and it was poured out into us little vessels. He said all knowledge should be more leveled out or even more circular. And so if you had a problem, you wouldn't try and give an answer. You would have what he called the problem-solving question, something that the educator, the animator, and the people would come together to try and solve. And he tried to lessen those hierarchies and pyramids. Now, this was taken up by a wonderful priest called Ernesto Cardinale. I think you've got him on your T-shirt. There you go. And the famous series of books, Love in Solentanami or Gospel in Solentanami, where they were experimenting with this form of pedagogy teaching. Instead of a sermon, the peasants, as they call them in the book, you know, the workers, the farmers, and artists and poets sort of struggled with the liturgy, with the words from the Bible together, and in a more circular, or what we call dialogical, form of liturgy. And the dialogical bit is really crucial, because you're not just listening to God, but you're listening to each other, you're listening to community. And it's trying to get away from that hierarchical notion that effectively came in when Constantine and that gang are kind of taking over the church. You know, when Constantine takes over, he needs an army, so he gets rid of the bit where Christians don't get involved with warfare. But he's also trying to find a way of legitimizing the way Christianity works. So they took the court system that was in the time, which had these big rooms with a hierarchy. At the end of each room, there was a platform, a raised bit. And the judge would have a stole that said he had the power to make judgments of people. And he just took over that. And we still have that. We still have normally a raised bit, or, you know, a bit where the person with power is a bit sitting above everyone else, still wearing the stole, saying he's got the power to have judgment over people. And it's mostly been he in Christian history. And even when we've got some breakthroughs, women priests, women bishops and that, they still mimic that hierarchical pattern that we've got. And I think liberation liturgy is trying to break all that down. It's trying to meet more in a more circular way, in a more dialogical way. It's trying to listen to each other and listen to what the Holy Spirit might have to say. And it needs to break that mirroring the hierarchies in the systems that we've got. So is that a starter for how liberation theology tries to break down?
Yeah.
All those barriers. You know, I never process. I don't like the idea of processing. I don't like there being, you know, this hierarchy of who's in the procession, who's at the front, who's at the back. I only wear very simple vestments, because I don't like the idea that some people are dressing up to look more important than other people. Mm. And we're always in our worship trying to find ways of groups coming together, responding to the Bible. So today we talked earlier, just before we went, about some people walked out of a sermon I was doing today. I didn't do a sermon. They walked out because suddenly I said, oh, I'd like you to talk to the people beside you about responding to this, the woman in the well. And one woman just couldn't deal with this. And she just got up and while everyone else sat and said, I did go with her and kind of said, are you okay? You know, and for her, she just couldn't do a worship service where we talk to each other and listen to each other. Because we've de-skilled people, we've got intelligent people who can't listen and can't talk to each other in a worship service. It's crazy. But luckily, the majority of people at the worship today loved it and learned new things about the Bible from listening to each other. So it's a dialogical forms of stuff are difficult because we're not used to it, but they're really rewarding for people when you get there.
Yeah, and I think it's important perhaps to note that those structures of hierarchy or whatever, just because, you know, I come from a lower than low Church of England background. I always joke that I consider high church to be a church and where a vicar wears a dog collar, like that is my like. But just because people aren't, you know, doing the kind of higher church stuff or dressing in certain ways, those hierarchies are still very much in play even in those sorts of churches. So it's, I think it's a question of looking at where the hierarchy is.
Mm.
Yeah, because those kind of structures can be very physical, you know, processions, dress and things like that. But the real hierarchies we're talking about are classism, racism, homophobia, sexism. They're the real things that our churches mimic, and in our policy and how we're structured. But I think to get past that, you need to listen to the views of women and LGBT people and black people. And the way you do that is by changing the structure of how our worship goes. But Lou, I'm really interested where you're studying and whether you found that colleges are excited about these ideas or whether they kind of keep those kind of more daring liturgical stuff at arm's length.
So I'm at the same college as Adam. So, you know, we have a good experience at Queen's of that. And there was an intentionality for me to come make the choice to come to Queen's, a lot of it to do with kind of liberation theology and radical inclusivity. I would say I'm more from a high church background, so I'm kind of generally more comfortable in those positions. But it's been interesting for me how I embody myself now. I'm involved not as a participant in the pews, but perhaps taking part in the processing or whatever or something like that. And I guess when you're training, you do what you're told in that sense about what that means or what that looks like, and kind of learning through observation or learning through just practice and that kind of thing. And what I guess I'm experiencing at the moment is realizing, okay, what brings me joy and what brings joy around, like what helps people to access God's love and what feels limiting for other people or limiting for myself and able to be authentic. I'm at a really amazing link church, my sort of attachment for the duration of my training. And last week, actually, we did a like four different questions, and we were kind of like in different groups throughout the service. And the vicar would say, okay, what I think one of the most powerful questions was, what do you think it feels like to be born? And like quite a vulnerable question, I guess. But actually all the different groups did that. And then when it came to the time of communion, we came up in our learning groups together. So rather than everyone like going one by one, it was like, okay, that group, that group, that group, that group. And there was something really nice about the fact that we'd been sort of learning together in those little segments and then going up for communion in that little learning segment, like it was a kind of blessing of that little group within the wider community of the church. So I was really inspired by that recently. I've been thinking a lot about Eucharistic theology and what that looks like in a kind of in terms of liberation. What do we hold on to? What do we get rid of? What's limiting and that kind of thing. I really like at Queen's in our chapel, we have a circular table. And I think even just the imagery of that can be really powerful when you sort of look into it a bit more.
The best church I've ever been involved with is in my yurt. I bought a yurt.
Amazing.
And the thing about a yurt is it has to be in the round.
Yeah.
And that round is a really beautiful image of the kingdom, you know, the kingdom of God, and that we're in a circle. Nobody is above anyone else. And I love the idea you've got around Eucharistic table. The Eucharist stuff and liberation. Obviously, the base ecclesial communities in the 50s and 60s in Africa and Latin America were often came about because there weren't enough priests around. So you know, Eucharist was done by lay people, you know, and it was a thing of the whole people, not just the clergy. It's one of the things we do struggle with in the church because, you know, for me, I'm not very. I don't think that I can have to be the only person who shares the Eucharist, and I love it when we're in a circle and we pass something around the home and everyone is ministers to each other. I know that's difficult for lots of people, but yeah, liberation theology is trying to just challenge always that hierarchy of who gets to do what and anything, even if it's done in the nicest possible way. Now, a lot of high church, you get a lot of loving, good socialists in high, but even so, it's still mirroring a hierarchy, which I don't think it's going to be present in the, you know, in the fullness of God's love.
There's something that I guess that I've been sort of thinking about, that sense of what do you do with your body in terms of movements and whether you're ascending or descending. You know, there was something that I read about, like where if you process the gospel, the deacon descends into the company of the people, in order to read the gospel. But actually, surely we shouldn't have been in the ascension point in the first place. Surely that should always be the case. And I was thinking back to in Corrymeela, where I've been on retreat a couple of times, and everybody descends into the croy, which kind of means like heart place, and it's a circular round and everyone goes down into it. And I think that feels like quite an authentic liberatory position, that there you don't everybody's descending down. There is no ascension in that liturgical space. And I love the fact that it, I mean, like, Croy, as I said, I think it's best translated as the heart, but it's kind of more than that, really.
It's a beautiful place. I've been there. It's lovely, isn't it? It's really very powerful place.
Yeah, really gorgeous. Yeah, and what does that mean for reconciliation as well, and having difficult conversations where everybody has to go down into something rather than go up? Sorry, that was my phone that just went. It was a Star Trek thing, and it was Adam that sent a message.
Was it the captain's on the bridge? Amazing.
There's captain on the bridge, yeah. Sorry. I didn't realise it was not on silent.
if I'm able just to, because I need to go quite soon, but I want to really push one thing, mm-hmm. and that is the work of Claudio Gavales, which, and if anyone's come across him, we had him at our Liberation Theology gathering 2 years ago. He's a Brazilian theologian. This work, Liturgies from Below, is, I think, the best piece of work on liturgies that there is at the moment.
I would second that. Cool. So that book is on my desk right now, and I draw from it regularly. So all I was doing really there is backing up on that, Chris. It's an absolutely fantastic book.
And at the start of it, it goes through the principles, doesn't it? The prayer is circular movement, working where you are. There's an incredible list of things that are really helpful for liturgy, like teach your church to imagine, engage with arts and artists, go to plays, watch movies, do exercises, different forms of movement in liturgy. Teach your church how to pray with the poor, listening to voices that I don't normally get to. I mean, there's about 20 really good bits of advice that are really practical about engaging liturgies, that actually listening to those who are often excluded. It's just a brilliant book, and Claudio's a friend and a very inspirational person. So there are people doing stuff that's born out of real lived out experiences. Mm. Liberation Theology is not in the past, it's in the now. It's about listening to vulnerable communities and making part of liturgy. And it's remembering that our prayers are often not including some people. Some people are excluded. Mm. They're not even in our communities. You know, so reaching out in a real sense of liberative mission, being alongside people in their struggles, all what liturgy should be about, or good liturgy is. And the process of this book was also going out to some of the poorest communities in the world and spending time with them and hearing their voices and translating that into their own words. It's a brilliant set of really helpful and practical ways of how to be liberation, having liberation liturgies. But I think people just also have to explore stuff in their own context. You know, you can't just push one thing into one place. Liberation theology is contextual, so it's working about where you are and working what actually can work and what doesn't work. So experiment. That's okay.
And I think there's a sense of having fun as well and finding joy and laughter. I think that's something that we forget about in our, possibly in our liturgical life, but in our Christian life, that actually there is real liberatory power in coming together and having fun. You know, that for me is like the ultimate two fingers up against the authorities in the establishment, actually, when you have a really good time, and that there's space for that to be nurtured within worship as well.
Claudia does puppet worships, things where everyone dresses up as clowns, all that kind of stuff. It really is that imaginative. And I think, you know, there's nothing worse than going into a church when they're talking about joy, the joy of God, the joy of the kingdom, as if joy has died. Joy is a person who has died.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, if it's the joy of God, then please, let's be joyous, for heaven's sake. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
In worship, remembering the times for lament, you know,
that's what I was going to say, you know, to push back a little bit, is that sometimes when I go into church, I'm not feeling like joy is where I am at the moment with God or with the world, and I do need that space and that time to lament or to be angry or whatever it is. And I think, you know, what I'm interested in is how do we have spaces that allow for all of those things, allow for the joy, but also allow for that lament as well. And I recognize that's difficult, because actually Everyone bar one person might be feeling wonderful that day, and that one person is just feeling like crap. And sometimes I think, you know, maybe it's just the case that, you know, you can't be, you know, all things to all people all the time, you know. But I don't know whether you've got any reflections on that.
I think you're more likely to be all things to all people if you give space to listen to them. That's a crucial bit of liberation liturgy. Mm. If you listen to people, then you can hear whether they need to be joyful, their reaction to the birth of their child, or whether they need space for lamenting because someone close to them has died. But you don't get anywhere near that if you're not listening to each other. Mm. But I don't think you can throw everything into one worship. And I think there's space for taizé worship, which is more reflective, you know, a space where there's storytelling. I mean, I'm talking about when your kids are involved in our service to this today, you know, we've got a lot of families coming in. And actually, you can tell and you can do service in a way that's joyous and engaging for young people. And you can, you know, I say you've got to read the people around you and give space for everything. And you can't have it all in one service. So
yeah.
Maybe you're being a bit greedy.
But I think as well, though, there's something in that about, you know, that whole sense of listening, where we have to think about the kind of culture that we're creating. Because actually, if I put together a service, whether that's just me or whether it's collaboratively or whatever it is, and something in that service it actually has the potential to make someone feel unsafe for some reason, you know, that's something I'm becoming a lot more aware of these days, because I've had a few instances of that myself where I felt unsafe in a service that someone else has, or some other people have been conducting. Or even recently, I put together a service where someone told me that there was something about that service that didn't make them feel safe. And I think that was a real learning curve. And I think, you know, if we're going to be liberative, you know, liberating communities, then we have to be always ready to take that fair critique, not just, you know, to just sort of say, oh, everything is terrible, I'm terrible, all the rest of it, but to be open to people being able to say, and let people know that they're able to say, actually, that was a problem for me for these reasons.
And I think that's how you need to build trust and communities together, isn't it? That emphasis on learning and listening, actually the way that people can feel safer or feel safe enough in spaces, because let's be honest, no space can thoroughly be safe because we don't know what's going to happen around the corner, or who, you know, X is going to say to Y or something like that, or an incident that happens. But actually learning and listening together and sharing in mutual vulnerability and trust together within a community, and, you know, a community that isn't kind of running on capitalist Tory principles or whatever, not the whole big society rubbish, but, you know, like actual kind of proper community. I think that's where we can build those relationships where actually people feel able to speak out and say when things aren't going so well, and able to speak into spaces when things are going so well, and holding that as best we can.
I mean, I think the other thing with that as well that it's probably worth mentioning is that we're also called to be kind of prophetic communities as well. And so sometimes that's actually going to mean that actually that space isn't safe. But I think the important thing is that has to be by invitation. You know, you can't conduct a church service on a Sunday morning and expect everyone to be able to come through the door and just enter into an unsafe space. That stuff has got to come later, I think.
Are there any last questions? Any last questions that anyone wanted? I don't know why you're asking me. I don't know any more than you lot. But
well, do you know what? I was about to say, I think the different thing you do have, potentially more than, certainly more than me, I think more than the other two, is experience of actually doing this stuff on the regular in kind of existing church communities where, you know, where you get to pull this together. And so I'd be interested to hear about some of your experiences of kind of being the person that's trying to pull a community towards some of this stuff.
Yeah, well, the one thing that's really important, it has to be voluntary. I mean, I think it's really hard. I don't even go into, like, if I'm invited to be a guest preacher, I don't go in and throw dialogical stuff at them and force them. It's never going to work, you know, and they're not prepared for it or whatever. So the community that I work with has developed this stuff over over 10 years in Sunderland, and you know, it's, so they're okay with it. They know how to listen to each other. But there are some core skills that you can use that are developed by a woman called Janet Lees. She was a URC, is a URC minister, and also a speech therapist, and did lots of stuff on linguistics. And she taught me at the Urban Theology Unit and has written numerous books, one of them very good called The Remembered Gospels. But her techniques of how you help people speak into spaces are really important. And here's the first one. Make sure everyone has spoken into the space at the beginning. You know, even if you've got a large, there's 100 people in the church, if they just talk to the person beside them, introduce themselves, given that space at the start of a service, if they've spoken into the space, they're more likely to be able to continue speaking in the space. If you suddenly stop and have a question and answer session, or say, has anyone got a question, or would anyone like to say anything, then hardly anyone will react to that, except for one or two very vocal people, or people trying to fill up the gap, you know, and it's not how it works. So making sure people said, spoken their name, you know, a very simple technique a lot of churches use is, or just say your name and, you know, something beautiful or difficult has happened to you this week. You know, it can be as simple as that, but starting off with that. When you get into discussions, go into the smallest group that you can. We normally ask people to go into pairs, threes if possible, but twos or threes. So you can do this if you've got 150 people in a congregation or you've got 30. You know, go into pairs, talk to the person beside you. And this means if you're reacting to a gospel story, everyone gets a chance to say their reaction to it. Mm. Now, Janet Lee's work is very simple in that she says, if you want people to live out the Gospels, live out discipleship, they have to know the stories of Jesus, internalize them, and work out what their response is. And if you don't give them a chance to verbally respond, then they don't internalize that, and they can't live out discipleship. Mm. So getting people into twos to share, or smaller groups as possible to share, is really helpful. If you've got quite a brave group that's kind of used to it, then you can ask those different pairs or threes or fours, whatever, to then share into the wider group. And at that point, you normally, if you're a note taker like me, I normally have a whiteboard. I might just put a word that comes out. So you end up with a whiteboard with some key words, hope, peace, justice, you know, inclusion, whatever, that's come from this collective sermon. And people can see that the sermon has come from them. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. They're very practical things. I was advising someone from a church in Cambridge last week, and they really enjoyed doing it. But small things. But all you'll have to read me book.
Yeah, we need to read your book. I need to read your book.
There was a chapter in it where I tried to spell out how we tried to do things more circular and how we tried to make sure. But also Janet Lees's work is a kind of maybe a better way of looking into this stuff. And there's loads of stuff from Latin America. I mean, you know, read the stuff from base ecclesial communities from the 60s, 70s, you know, 80s, 90s, and even most modern stuff. Really good. The Women's Gathering Church, I can't remember the book, looking at the womanist churches, and I think it's called Womanist Gatherings, but a really good book about how there's a new series of services in the States based around womanist experiences, how they use getting people to speak together is brilliant. So lots of stuff in there.
Amazing. That's so cool.
Even a wedding. When I do a wedding, you know, there's a point when I warn people before, I said, like, before I do the sermon, there's a bit, we're going to say, what would you want to advise people if they get married? What keeps your marriage together? What went wrong when it got divorced? You know, share some wisdom. And I get a mic out, I give people mics, and you get real beauties, real nuggets of wisdom from people, real lived experiences who know the couple and love the couple. So there's no place where you can't share that, even a funeral. You know, what's the best funerals you've ever been to? When people who know the person who's died share a moment of beauty from that person's life.
Mm.
You know, everything needs to be inclusive and dialogical.
Hear, hear.
Chris, it's been absolutely brilliant having you on. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
Is there anything you want to plug before you disappear?
Well, Liberation Theology Gathering, it will hopefully be back this year. So the end of October.
Hooray!
We'll have a gathering I've got to put something on the Victor Hara Liberation Theology Facebook page just to see who's interested in helping organising it. But, you know, hopefully we'll be back in Sunderland, but maybe also have something online for people from further away to take part in that. So that'll be the last weekend in October, Liberation Theology Gathering. And I always like to say, anyone is welcome to come up and spend some time in our house. We've got three students living with us at the moment. There's always room on the sofa or a mattress for more. People come and use our 5,000 books on Liberation Theology if they're doing a particular piece of dissertation or research. And as long as they get involved with Sunderland and see our beaches and come along to one of our Liberation worships, that's great. But people can come up and spend a couple of days with us. They're very welcome. Think about Liberation Theology Gathering at the end of October. I know Adam's already excited about it. He's dribbling.
I am finally going to come along. I've been wanting to come for a long time. So I will be there for sure. I will brave going north of, Birmingham, really. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Thank you for Chris for joining us. We are on all the podcast feedy places, and we would love it if you left us a review, because apparently that's good. We have a Patreon that I can't ever remember the link for, but if you'd like to thirst some pennies for hosting fees, you know where we are. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/breadandrosaries. We are Twitter at @bread_rosaries. You can email us breadandrosaries@gmail.com. Please do get in touch. We love to hear from people. Adam, where in the world can people find you?
You can find me most places at commiexian.
Brilliant. Lou, you are not on the internet because you are sophisticated AI, but is there anything that your extremely complicated circuitry would like to communicate before we go?
Absolutely not.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Right, anyway, God bless everyone.
Cheers,
take
Chris.
Care. Nice to meet you, Lou. You. Good luck.
Bye. Nice to meet you. Bye. Bye.
I don't know how to leave the session.
big red button at the top.
This is leave top session, right. Top right.
I can see it. I'm pressing.